Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
Hello and welcome to the Carpcast 69. A good number for everyone, I'm sure. Yeah, I just skipped that, I think.
Well, in poker, the best hand in... not the best hand, aces is the best hand, but a pretty good hand to get all the money in with is ace-king. And it's called... They call ace-king the big slick. And if you have 6-9, they call it the big lick.
I think where they get that from.
No. But yeah, episode 69. Me poorly. That's why you can do the intro, Mark. You can do most of the talking. Because you're all refreshed, aren't you, from chasing the Iceman?
No, that was not a refreshing holiday in the slightest. But that sucks me down to the ground. I'm not one for sitting on a beach and just vegging out and getting burnt and, you know, partying in the evening. That's not my sort of holiday. So we went to Iceland, chasing the Northern Lights, looking for White Walkers. And I was hoping to stumble across the film in a Game of Thrones and get a part as an extra, but they'd already finished. Quite disappointing. I think I'd make a good wildling.
I must be the only person in the world that's never seen Game of Thrones, so I didn't even know it was in Iceland.
Part of it is, but you need to listen. Game of Thrones, there's like violence, breasts, sex, zombies, and dragons. Tell me what more you want from your TV.
It to be on Netflix or Amazon Prime or one of the other things I subscribe to that it's not on.
I'm sure it'll be found streamable somewhere in a perfectly legal manner, obviously.
Of course. So yeah, you had a good time. I saw some amazing pictures of the Northern Lights. You've seen them properly this time?
Oh, properly, just a bit, mate. We've been to Iceland before, and we just got a bit of a green fuzz in the sky before. Not much. Certainly nothing worth trying to get the camera out with. And this time it was our third attempt. I mean, we did see them the first two, but it was just cloud cover kind of ruins it. Now, for the Northern Lights, you need clear skies, obviously, so you can see them. But also, you need, like, the geomagnetic activity or whatever the scientific cause of them are. And that has to play ball as well. And on this third night, we had a drove up into the hills. The forecast was good. And, we got lucky. We're very, very blessed to see what we did. I mean, our intention was to drive up to like a little cafe at the top of a hill in the middle of nowhere, like a little truck stop sort of thing. You know, big car park, it's top of a hill, there's huge amounts of sky around it. But we didn't get there. You know, we're going up and I says to my wife, you know, have a look around the window, see if you can see any lights yet, see if they're there. And she's like, oh, there's no this side, no, not over there. She looked out the back window and I'm not repeating what she said, but she saw the lights and they were... You know, big time. So we pulled up at the next opportunity. It was like a big, not even a big, it was like an old turning into a field or a farmhouse or somewhere down there. But it was just enough to park up. You know, there's a little bit of room. There's great big mountains of snow, which had been cleared from the road. And it was just, there were the lights. I mean, to start with, it was just like green streaks of like fuzz in the sky. And you watched them closely, you could see them like undulating every now and then, or a little spot would get brighter and then fade away. But what I'd done earlier that day, I'd sent Ollie Davis and a good mate of mine, doesn't go fishing, but a lad called Duncan Norburn, you know, his business is photography, and everyone knows how good Ollie is, he is the man. And the you know, both replied to me with hints and tips on how to get the Northern Lights, and they told me slightly different things, but you know, a lot of the same stuff. So basically, you know, play around with this and that, and you know, I took their advice and you know, got quite a few shots. But we had one point where, for about 90 seconds, 2 minutes, there was what is apparently called a geomagnetic storm. And you know, where you've seen on telly, where's the lights and they start like, you know, flashing all around and just dancing. And you just think, well, that's you think it's a time lapse and it's speeded up and that. Well, that's what I assumed anyway. And that wasn't. It was like the sky just had this big green orgasm over our heads. It was incredible, honestly, an incredible sight. I mean, at one point, it was so bright, my wife took a selfie with her mobile phone and got the lights on them. It was an incredible sight. I mean, it's also the coldest I've ever been. Because you imagine, I mean, up in there, it was minus 14 on the car. It was also blowing an absolute hooligan up there as well. It was, I took my gloves off to like make adjustments on the camera, and they were instantly, not just numb from cold, but, you know, that spiky, painfully cold feeling. Yeah, but, we got the pictures. I got a hell of a lot of crap pictures, but, you know, it was a good thing with digital nowadays. You just reel off as many as possible, and you only need a small number of good ones, and managed to get them. I'm not one of the most accomplished photographers in the world by a long shot, but I'm very pleased with what I got. The only thing I should have done different, which I said to my wife when we got back the other day, I should have taken the picture with myself in my shorts doing my Wim Hof meditation pose on sat on the snow with the lights behind me. I think that would have been cool.
I did see a picture of you with just your shorts on, snow angeling in the cold. How was that?
Uncomfortable.
Yeah, it was. What temperature was it then?
I think freezing.
Yeah.
But it barely got above minus two even through the day. But where that was, that's why I was in my shorts. I'd actually just got out of the sea, walked across the beach to the snow. But it's in the sea was 1.7 degrees.
Mm.
The sea in this little enclosed cove was apparently 1.9. And behind this beach, there's a big rectangle geothermal spa place. That was 38 degrees.
Wow.
So I didn't just like rock up and jump in the sea. That would be stupid and dangerous. But the, that place, you go into the changing rooms and you come out, and we were sat in the, you know, the hot tub chilling for a bit. My Icelandic licorice sweets are repeating on me. But you'd be sat there, you'd see these, for want of a better word, all these pensioners. They come out of the changing rooms, they've got the budgie smugglers on, or the swimming cosies, a pair of like neoprene gloves, neoprene socks, a woolly hat, and they're swimming up and down in the sea.
Wow.
Then they come get in the hot tub and go out. I mean, they must like... They're just so healthy, some of the people over there, especially that generation, because you're looking at them, you know, they're the men. There's an old fella, he's got the body of, I don't know, well, a lot better than mine, put it that way. You know, he's still got muscle definition. You look at him in the face, and he's obviously, I don't know, 70 or 80. He might even be in his 120s, I don't know. But, you know, they swim in the sea, they have hot tubs, and they eat haddock and kelp.
I've been doing my cold showers. I've had a minute of cold pretty much every shower I've had for the last few months, and I have the worst chest cough and cold I've had in years. But I think some of that, I did kind of run my body down, got absolutely wasted on Sunday night, and literally when I woke up following day, I was streaming from all over, and it settled deep into my chest, which is a bit of a nuisance because I'm going to France this week on the trip to John Max Lake with a few of the lads. Shout out to Rich from Fired Up Barbecues, to the Cumbrian lads, to Nick and the others. Got a right good group of lads going with us actually on Friday, and to be honest, if we were going today, I wouldn't have been going. I felt like death this morning. To the point now, well, it's a good job I've got a mute button on this mic, because I've had about four coughing fits already in the 15 minutes we've been online. Oh no, 10 minutes we've been recording. I've had about four coughing fits while you've been talking. So yeah, I apologise if I go silent. I'll have muted the mic. But I ended up getting wasted because I had another pretty good week at the poker. I had a right good start to the year, considering I didn't play much last year. Played like professionally the year before last year. Didn't do a lot because was busy with other stuff, and this year it's been absolutely flying. I've had like four final tables of pretty major, competitions, and then I do like to treat myself. And you've been like concentrating for, it was like a 3-day comp this week, and when I bust out in 12th place on Sunday, and then you just feel like having a blowout because it's like, it's very mentally draining. You focus for like 12 hours a day, 3 days in a row, and then I just felt like a few of our Carpcast listeners, it was on there, it was live streamed as well, and I was on the feature table on the live stream, and I was getting messages off a few Carpcast listeners that also play poker that were messaging me and watching. They were like, oh, I saw you come third the other last week in a different one, and but yeah, you just feel like blowing out at the end of it, and I think that's what's caused this this illness. And I haven't caught a carp yet this year. I went fishing last week before, down to Nash's. A couple of our friends had rented the Church Lake, so we went down and did a few days with them on the cops. Briggsy caught it just right, temperature-wise. He managed to bag one of the ones that had bred on in there at the cops the day we arrived. But then he just caught the end of the really mild weather, all that warm winds and storm that we had. I think when we arrived, the water was 9 degrees. The following morning, it was 8. Wow. The following day, it was 7.5. And it just completely dried up. Reedy, who runs the Northern Angling Show with us, he had a couple of 30s out of Church on Ziggs. Spenny foul hooked an upper 30 on a Zig. They're definitely moving about, but all the fish that were caught were completely covered in leeches. Our Matty had a couple off the bottom as well. So the Church Lake did a few bites. It's done a few this week, actually. There's a couple of guys on there have had fish to 40-odd. I think they might have had a couple of 40s, actually, this week. And it's only Wednesday, is it? Wednesday today. So lakes seem to be turning on. We're talking about water temperature. I mean, I'm pretty sure carp aren't feeding in 1.9 degrees or whatever your little sea was. But I find this time, as soon as the weather starts hitting like 9 degrees, the water temperature starts hitting 9 degrees, it's like flicking a switch, you know, bites start happening, fish start showing. And I think the key is it being on the up. So Roger arrived there last night. I think he took the temp when he got there last night. I think it was about 8 degrees, and it had gone up again by this morning. They've had sort of overcast and drizzle, so the water temperature is a lot colder up north. I actually did a tuition. Shout out to Carl Gibbs, one of excuse me. Shout out to one of our listeners. He came and did a tuition with me up on Clearwater Fisheries. And Heapy Bob came down and took some pictures. He also took some underwater footage with his all singing, all dancing bait boat with underwater cameras and GPS and Lord knows what's on it. And the water was 6.3, which is really cold. Although it has done I think the stock ponds have been doing a few fish on Ziggs from what I've read today. Actually, Alex has made a post. You might have noticed on the Carpcast page and on the official Carpcast fan page, we've been sharing the Clearwater videos. You can actually see there's a presentation of what's actually been the development that's going on those lakes. And I keep saying it, I've said it a lot of times, that's going to be one of the best complexes, definitely in the north and certainly potentially the country. The work that Alex is doing down there is amazing. The bun's gone in, all the otter fencing's finished. He's had a lot of the fish. There's a lot more coming. He's redeveloping the actual structure of the lakes. I think they planted 5,000 trees last week, a week before last. It's amazing what they're doing. Go and check out the video. If you live in the northern half of the country, then I strongly recommend you check it out. The main lake's going to be an exclusive syndicate from next year. You can fish on a day ticket this year, but it'll be syndicate only next year. There will be a waiting list, so I advise you, it's going to be one of the best fisheries around. So if you live in the northern half of the country and you fancy it, then it'd be worth checking out clearwaterfisheries.co.uk to get your name down on it. And then the Kellets, the Runs water that they're doing is going to be fantastic as well. I'm actually quite excited just about fishing the Runs water. So yeah, that's Clearwater. It was wet, muddy. Obviously, they've had all the diggers and trucks down there, and God knows what, doing all this redevelopment. It was pretty muddy on the section that we fished. Carl and I grinded it out. We didn't catch any fish, but he was a top lad. I'm going to take him back there again once the weather warms up a little bit and make sure he catches one. But it was a slog. It was cold. It was like, it felt like, you know, see the pictures of Daryl in the mud on the Orient. That's what it felt like. But it's only one corner that's like that, where they've been doing the work and putting the fence in. But we thought it was the best chance of a bite down there because fish had been showing, and we cut it back onto the to one of the stock ponds. Excuse me. And then we still blanked, but we felt it was the best chance of nicking a bite, although it didn't go to plan. But yeah, it was uncomfortable. I was like, that's me rods hung up for a week or two. Yeah, as soon as that water starts hitting, or certainly as soon as the water starts going up. I mean, you can even tell, like, have you ever noticed, like, just the water out of your tap, like when you're making a cold drink, and just feeling, because obviously those pipes are underwater, they're not too deep under the ground, but there's a noticeable difference when the sort of temperature starts rising as the days are getting longer. You know, we're 12 on sunlight now, aren't we? It's light at 6:30 in the morning till 6:30 in the evening. We've got a full 12 hours of daylight, and I think that makes a hell of a difference. But you can just tell, yeah, you can tell just from the temperature of the water coming out the tap, the difference in there. And you can tell with the cold showers as well. I mean, at the minute, when I blast that to cold in the frozen north, you really do know that it's cold. As soon as that starts getting a bit more bearable, then I think it's probably time to get the rods out. But yeah, I'm on Francis coming week with a group of lads, and there was a few people on there last week or the week before, actually, John Mack said, and they had about 24, 25 fish or something. Up to 40s, so I'm actually looking forward. If by the time we do our next show I still haven't caught a carp this year, then might be time to sell my gear, I think. Have you had one this year yet?
No, not yet. My excuse being that I have hardly been through you know, one or two other things, but I'm like a coiled spring, like a coiled serpent ready to strike. Ticket for the new syndicate starts at the...
You sound more like a coiled robot at the minute. You sound more like a coiled robot than a coiled spring. But...
oh, fair enough. How about the machine then? I'll be like a machine.
A coiled machine. Yeah, when's your new ticket?
Something like Wally. Middle of March, middle of this month.
Right.
Middle of this month, and I'm itching to go.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know. Will we have recorded by that time or just after? So I can tell you how I've blanked on the new lake.
Yeah, well, I'm back on the 18th of March. I've got a band rehearsal on the 19th, which is the Sunday, with the Carp Supergroup in preparation for playing at the Northern Angling Show. You shall be there, Mark, I believe. Playing rock.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, what's happening is... the Northern Angling Show on the Saturday, which is the 1st of April, from 4 p.m. till 7 p.m. we're having a few drinks in the bar. We've got entertainment, we've got DJ on in there, we've got two bands, we've got Clive Gibbons of Corder fame and Yorkshireman, we've got his band, who are a very accomplished band that play regularly, you know, professional band that play most weekends, and we've got the or some of the members of the Carp Society Supergroup, which is calling it the NAS Carp Supergroup. There's going to be Lee Jackson, former world record holder. Jacko's going to be there playing bass. Myself, Clive Gibbons on drums. We've got a chap called Paul Wild, who's a carp angling singist, pretty good rock singer. And who's the other chappy? We do have... someone else. Oh, Sam. Trafford Sam, as I used to call him, or Sam Clifton from the Marina. Sam Torrow is an extremely accomplished musician himself. Top lad. He's had many big Northwest fish. He had the big plated over the winter, actually, out of St. John's, if you remember. He also had the record catfish the week before, like bloody £900 or something, out of St. John's. But yep, Sam is playing guitar and singing, and that's all going on the Saturday the 1st at the Northern Angler Show between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. Just a few drinks. It'll mainly be exhibitors and people at the show, but obviously any guests that are at the show on the Saturday are welcome to come and have a few beers with us and get down. We've got a pretty decent DJ playing as well, just doing like a disco-y sort of house set. Pretty well-known stuff, and yeah, just a few drinks and a bit of food after the show. It's more of a thank you to the exhibitors for supporting us. I think we've got 170 exhibitors this year at the show. 14,000 metres of floor space. Yeah, it's going to be a crazy one. Ticket sales are 50% up on last year, and we had best part of 10,000 people there last year. So yeah, it's going to be a really, really good one this year. And if you haven't already got your tickets, you can pay on the door. It's a tenner for adults. It's a bit less for concessions, and under 12s are free. And northernanglishow.co.uk is a website where you can have a look at all the VIP packs. There's like CC Moore packs, Nash packs, various different companies. You can buy like a VIP pack, which is basically a gift and a free ticket, and it's quite a good value. But yeah, check it out. Northernanglishow.co.uk. 1st and 2nd of April is when the show is. Come and see me play some songs that I haven't had time to learn. And yeah, should be.
Are you going to give us a little hint at your playlist, or do you take requests?
No, we don't take requests. The tricky one's going to be Leonard Skinner, Treebird. That's like, it's the guitar song, isn't it? That's going to be a bit of a tricky one there. Most of the other songs are ones that we played at when I did the gig with the Carp Society Supergroup in Essex. Just before Christmas, most of the songs are ones we played there. Stuff like Free, All Right Now. I think there's a Black Sabbath track in there, Paranoid. There's a few rock tracks. So yeah, if you can get down, then yeah, come and have a few beers with us in the Fisherman's Rest, which is the bar that we're building inside Event City. Should be pretty good fun, I think. Yeah, quite looking forward to that. On the net, Mark, said a few things this week.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Over the past week or two since we've not recorded, but let's start off with a very positive note. Terry Herner's dog, the one he's been chasing, the parrot from Cranwell's Lake on the Wazen Estate at £63, one of the biggest carp in the country, and I believe a PB for Terry.
Yes, certainly his PB. I mean, I kind of hope that he would catch the second British record. But I'm sure he's still super happy anyway.
Yes.
I believe he caught like the entire stock numerous times before he caught that one.
I believe it. The lake punished him a bit, made him go through everything. But I think he just muted his own coffee fit again. But yeah, there's one fish I said, Terry, with from there was, I think it was a mid 40, another linear in there called the floppy tail linear. Did you ever see that one?
I didn't see the pictures of it. I know he just caught them all, which he did on Burfield as well, didn't he? I think he caught most of them out there. And there's a few of the fish he's caught have made him wait, where he's had to catch the entire stock numerous times. Because I think the parrot, I think he is a quite a friendly one. You know, I think numerous times he was there and witnessed people on their first fish catching that one. It just goes like that. The lady used to do that, didn't it? Shout out to the lady at St. Ives.
The lady, she could punish people. I mean, I know, do you remember two lads called Phil and Darren?
Yes.
I mean, they fished over the other side a lot on the shallow in Long Reach. But I think one of them had like two big black Labradors and, you know, a lovely pair of fellas. And one of them, I can't remember which, but ventured over onto the lagoon and got the lady on his first morning.
Yeah.
And they always used to fish together. So that left the other one thinking, oh, well, I want to go over there, but I'm on my own. But he went over there and got it on his first night.
It's funny, isn't it? And, you know,
it
was Terry's first fish after, 60-odd nights? Took me 60-odd nights to catch it. Took Daryl 60-odd nights to catch it. You know, and I can think of three or four people off the top of my head that had it as their first fish. So it's a funny one, those
first
funny
fish
ones.
Of first night.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, last time it was my
my third fish, but I'd done 40 odd nights to get there over a season and a half.
Yeah.
But then you've got other very, very capable anglers like remember Si Giblin?
Yeah.
He's one. He went through. I think he was getting repeats. Went through a lot of the stock, and it took him, a good few years to catch it. But eventually, did. And I believe he's one of these people that he was just over 60.
Yeah, and then you look at John Mack, who fished it hard for 2 years and didn't catch that one. It's funny with the friendly ones, and obviously, the Parrots made Terry wait for it, but. From all that I read, he's super chuffed, doesn't care about the weight, doesn't matter if it's not a record, he's just made up, quite rightly it should be. I think I read a quote that basically the longer he took to catch it made it more of an experience when he did, so it tends to be how it goes, doesn't it? So somebody else has caught a big fish that I've seen on the net this week is Dave Levy. Have you noticed that?
It's on the net, it must be true.
Oh, he's carried on smashing up Horton.
He has. He's had the second ever 50 out of Horton, Church Lake, just not long after he's been announced Carp Angler of the Year. I think that's it's kind of a fitting tribute to an amazing 12 months that he's had, I think. He's had loads and loads of big fish. He had multiple hits of 40s, and he's now had... a rare thing for Horton, a 50 pounder. So, big up to Dave Levy. He was a guest on one of the earlier Carpcasts.
Do you think it might be worth time to hit him up for another chat just about his amazing season and maybe we can learn a bit from it?
Yes, yeah, certainly. We'll speak to Dave. I've got a list of decent guests coming up. Obviously, this show is finally tracked down Danny Fairbrass and managed to get a decent interview with Danny. Yeah, thoroughly enjoyed that. The next bit of news on the net that I've seen actually is somebody that we've been trying to get on the Carpcast for ages and you haven't managed to tie him down yet, but that's Mr. Terry Edmonds.
It's on the net, it must be true.
He's been in the news this week for he's completed a goal that he's been trying for quite some time, and that is to hit 250 yards with a cart rod and an overhead cast. He's finally done it. He says it was a self goal, something he wanted to do, and it created a bit of fuss on his Facebook page. Have you seen it?
I've seen a bit of it, yeah. But firstly, well done, Terry. That is an absolutely awesome cast. When you think the average, 254 yards, I believe it was. And that's just on an overhead cast. It was on a flat field. It's not measured on wrapping sticks or anything daft. It's actually measured out. And it was... I'll tell you what I want to bring up here as well, which I found interesting. There's a lot of these high-end cart reels now have got super slow oscillation.
Yeah.
Terry was using a Daiwa wind cast, which doesn't.
Really?
So does super slow oscillation make any difference at all? If Terry can smash a cast out like that...
Interesting.
And also, if Terry had cracked off, would he have put a new crater on the moon?
Yeah, I mean it's a massive cast. That's a double what I can comfortably cast.
You've got a Babo, you don't cast it.
I mean that's pretty severe. I mean, yes, it drops a significant amount off when you've got a rig and a hook bait. I know most of these casting things are done without a hook bait, just a bare lead, which makes a hell of a difference. I mean, to actually fish at 250 yards with a rig on, I think is probably impossible. But as I say, now I've seen when I went on a casting thing with Terry in Romania a few years back, I did see him cast 200 metres with just a lead then, normal overhead cast. So, I mean, there's a video of him doing it, isn't there? You can see it's pretty impressive, his technique. I mean, he's broke all sorts of records. Terry is an extreme caster. As usual with the internet these days, a few negative Nigels were posting on his the usual story, the internet knockers trying to put things down. I was discussing on one of the threads, actually, with... about... Excuse me, it's a right tickly cough, this. But I'm discussing about... you know, the effect of bait boats. And somebody made a golfing analogy. You know, I think somebody put on his thread, like, how far can you hit a golf ball? And it suddenly dawned on me that, let's say you picked a golf ball up from the tee and got in your golf buggy and drove yourself to the green and then just dropped the ball near the hole.
That sounds good to me.
Is that the golfing analogy of bait boats? Is that basically the equivalent? I mean, the whole skill in golf is being able to get the ball where you want it to go, and surely that's a pretty important skill in fishing, is being able to put the rig where you need it to go. And is it the same? Just getting in your golf buggy and picking the ball up and driving it to the green, dropping it?
Yeah. How have we got from Terry's biblical casting to bait boats?
Because that was what a lot of the arguments was about. You know, some people saying it's absolutely pointless what he's just done. You know, which,
well, let's be honest, some of the most fun things in life are pointless. So that is just a totally void comment. Whoever says it's pointless and he shouldn't be doing it, have a word with yourself.
Yeah, there's a few people that need to have a word with himself on the net this week, and one of them, he's now known as McNutjob. Have you seen Sean McNutt?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yeah, I'll tell you the story. Dean Macy, top guy. Absolutely lovely fella, very keen angler, star of The Big Fish Off, co-host with Ali Hamidi. He's at the Northern Angling Show every year. He's there this year. He's just a top all-round guy. Apparently he goes to Gillam's in Thailand on holiday, has been doing for years, goes with his missus as a two-week holiday, and he had it right off this time. And I mean right off. I was seeing pictures every day of another 100-pounder, another 100-pounder, all Siamese carp. He had loads. I think he had 15 different fish over 100-pound. Now, I saw I wasn't counting them, but I saw numerous videos and pictures of these monstrous fish, to the point of it making me want to go. You know, I was like, wow. I quite like the look of that. Didn't think anything of it. He's come home, he's put a load of pictures up, said it was an amazing trip. Forget how many fish he had, but he had a lot of fish over 2 weeks, and over 1,500 pounders. No reason to think any different till this Sean McNutt, who owns a rival venue, of which I won't mention the name because I don't think he deserves it, but he owns a rival venue in Thailand, and basically called Dean out for being a complete liar in extremely backwards English, adding to the fact I don't think this guy's particularly I think he's a boilie short of a kilo anyway, let's put it that way. He in pidgin English basically called Dean out for lying, saying that he gets free holidays and there's no chance that he had those fish. It was basically calling the venue out and calling Dean out. It just made this McNutt job look crazy. I mean, it was literally the worst piece of marketing I've ever seen. He's basically trying to say, if you want bites, come to my place. We have a money-back guarantee if you don't catch, type thing. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know anything about either venue, but it's kind of like trying to compare Yateley Car Park Lake with Brazenhose. You know, Brazenhose might want to offer a money back guarantee because you're pretty much guaranteed to catch. And, you know, Yateley Car Park is not about that. It's about catching special big fish. Like, it's just chalk and cheese. Why would you ever compare them? And it seems to be that, first of all, that's what this guy's trying to do. But for some reason, he seems threatened by this session that Dean's had, I think he's attempted to use it as promotion for him, saying that they're obviously lying, come to him if you want like loads of bites, he's the only place to guarantee someone's money back if you don't catch. And it's like, I don't know, I've never seen something so ignorant, bitter, twisted, naive. Like, it's done the absolute opposite of what you want to do in marketing. And I made a comment on his thing to kind of say that, and I got blocked fairly instantly, as anybody else's, which there's been a lot of people telling him what an idiot he is. Focus on what you do, you know. There's enough in this world for all of us. Like, you don't have to be threatened by somebody else catching a fish, or, you know, if you're fishing for a target fish, be pleased for somebody that catches that fish. You know, you've learned something. You found out where, when, what, why it got caught. And, you know, it's we don't live in something that's finite. It's not like it's the last time that fish will ever get caught. And it really annoys me when people are not pleased for other people's successes. I'm not one of them people. I'm always happy for other people doing well, whatever it is, whether it's in business, fishing, you know, and any walk of life. You know, it makes me feel good that somebody else has got something that they wanted, or they're happy, or whatever it is, because I don't feel threatened by other people. You know, I concentrate on making myself happy, and don't worry too much about I don't worry too much about what other people do. It's counterproductive. And, you know, how can you enjoy any of your own successes when you're so miserable the rest of the time? It's like, you probably don't even enjoy it when something good happens to yourself. So I really don't get this guy, this Sean McNaught. He's probably done himself way more harm than good. I don't know what his intention was. And, you know, this calling out somebody who's about as stand up a guy as I've ever seen. You know, Dean's a top guy, and I don't know anybody. I've never heard anything to the point. And, you know, Dean made the point. Dean's now copied and pasted this post and obviously put it on his own page. There's just hundreds of people, you know, saying what an idiot this other guy is. It's like, you know, Dean says, I'm not letting this drop because, you know, this guy's called me a liar. He's calling my integrity. Do you think, you know, the guy's a former Olympian, a stand-up guy, you know, big in the fishing industry, and is he going to put his name to something that's a complete lie? It's just not going to do it. I don't for one second doubt the session that he had. Like, it just doesn't happen. You know, it's very rare that sort of thing happens in fishing. I assume you read it all, did you?
I did, yeah. It did make me think, was, you know, Mr. McNutt job, was he posting drunk or something? Because it just came across as a bit of a drunken rant.
He's made a couple of posts since.
Direction.
He's made a couple of posts since saying pretty much the same thing. So, you know, maybe he's an alcoholic and he's permanently drunk. I don't know. I wouldn't know that. I have no information, but yeah, I saw a few people say this guy must clearly be drunk, but the fact that he made a couple of other similar posts, and maybe he's so offended by, you know, somebody else, I don't know, it absolutely baffles me. Ironic, his name kind of sums up the post. Yeah, a little bit crazy. I just want to tell you quickly about VIP Carp Holidays. You can go to vipcarpholidays.com. There aren't many weeks left for this year, but we have two fantastic venues in the River Lot, where you get a villa for up to 8, maybe even 10 people, with your own private fishing space, all the equipment. Everything you need is down there. There's catfish to over £100, carp to £60 out of that stretch. Villa with a pool and everything. It's absolutely fantastic. There's 3 or 4 weeks left this year, so you can still get on for 2017, or you can start booking up for 2018. I think all of August is gone in 2018 now, but there are still plenty of weeks available in 2018. And a similar type of venue, a family venue is what we look at, is St. Armand Leisure. St. Armand have featured quite a bit on the earlier carp cast. Ben Smethurst has been out there and did an on the bank feature from there. He's back again soon, actually. He's going to do it again for us because he had an absolutely fantastic holiday. Same thing, there's like family games rooms, the farmhouse sleeps 10 people, there's always like table tennis table in there, and you get private 4.5 acre lake with hundreds of carp to £50. It's like a 5 to 10 fish a day type venue. You don't even need to fish at nights. So it's great, perfect for a family holiday, meals in the French village and stuff. Anyway, you can get more info from vipcarpholidays.com. Again, there's a couple of weeks in April if you were looking for a holiday fairly soon. I think there's 2 weeks available in April in 2017. All of November is free at St. Armand. If you want to book a holiday for later this year, and I think there's 1 or 2 odd weeks aside from that, and then it's 2018 you start taking bookings for next year, which if you want a French holiday at a decent venue, you do have to book in advance. So VIPCupHolidays.com. Stan will also be at the Northern Angling Show, so he'll be able to come speak to us direct. But the last few weeks in 2017 are filling up very fast, so if you haven't already, what I'm saying is don't leave it to the Northern Angling Show if you are fancying a week this year. So yeah, anything else, Mark, that you've seen?
On the net. It must be true.
Yeah, big news for the Carp Society. The good guys have won. Have you seen this on Tim Paisley's Facebook? I'm going to get it up now. I'm not going to read it all out because it's quite a long post, but there's a little extract of it. It says there's a press release going out from the Carp Society announcing the four deposed directors, Malcolm Collar, David Manol, Derek Buxton and Shane Thompson, have conceded defeat in the boardroom battle and will play no further part in society affairs as directors or members.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'd also say to everyone, keep an eye on Carp Talk and Carp World, you know, publications that Tim Paisley will be writing all about the Saga 4, and I'm sure a lot of it that has not been able to be brought to light while it was still ongoing in the courts and that will come to light, and also see where the Carp Society goes forward from here. Will it bring back the regions, bring back the fishings? We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I've seen loads of talks about getting some of the old things going. I think now the control is back with the rightful people, it's going to be good for carp fishing. If you listen to the Tim Paisley episode, was a couple of episodes ago, Tim, you know, I asked Tim about, you know, one of the reasons for the Carp Society, and he said about it being a political organisation. You know, the CAA, which was the BCSG's sort of entry level carp group, you know, they had no interest in anything political, and it's been quite instrumental in a lot of law changes, you know, having a body that speaks up for the benefit of carp anglers. And go back and have a listen to the Tim Paisley episode if you haven't already, where he kind of explains the reasons. It converted me. Well, not that I needed converting, but it certainly reinforced why we need a carp society looking out for the benefit of anglers, and one that's, you know, non-profit, that's there for, you know, to put back into carp fishing, to bring on the youngsters. It's fantastic. And I spoke to Derek Stritton, who's one of the founder members as well, and he's heavily involved with it currently, and Derek did promise to me that once it was all settled legally, he would come on and spill the beans, basically give us the gossip. He said there's a lot of stuff he couldn't say that had been going on, and you know, he was happy to get it out in the open on the Carpcast once that was done. So we will have Derek on very soon. So we have one of the main men himself, Mr. Derek Stritton. One of the original founding members of the Carp Society, were you? Was that right?
I was, Jamie, yeah. I attended the inaugural meeting in Sheffield in 1981 and went straight onto the board at that time, or as it was, yeah, a committee it was in those days. And additionally, I ran the Essex region of the Carp Society with social events and fundraising in the early days.
So it must have broke your heart to see what a business it became. You know, later on, the recent management, it was just a business and doing nothing for carp angling, wasn't it, for quite a few years?
Well, it was. I mean, when I was last involved, which was in the 90s, I got back involved at that time purely and simply because there was a bit of a cash flow problem. I mean, everybody since then, the new directors that took over, made it sound like an absolute crisis. It was purely and simply that we had that debenture scheme on Horseshoe Lake, and until such time as the 11-year permits ran out, we weren't able to use Horseshoe as a fundraiser. And once we got into that, obviously the Carp Society was always going to be solvent and it was always going to be successful. When I and Tim and Rob Hughes and various other people stepped aside in the 90s, it was the Carp Society still had about 5,000 members. It was producing regular magazines and conferences, and slowly but surely over time, they all began to disappear. And when Tim spoke to me about the situation in 2015, it became quite apparent that the The people in control at that time had raised the membership cost to £95, had withdrawn the magazine, were only running one conference, weren't offering really anything for anybody to join, and they'd also introduced a non-membership but passport scheme for anyone who wanted to fish Horseshoe Lake or the two syndicate lakes, Farriers and Langholm. So the result was, when this kind of whole thing escalated, we realised there were only, I think, 10 alleged members plus the two vice presidents.
And that was...
Which was how I...
That was a deliberate effort by the current management, wasn't it, apparent that they were trying to, you know, gain access to the assets for themselves, disassociated with the company or with the group, and... for personal gain, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I don't think, to be fair, in the whole of the case that we've had going on over the last 10 months since we held our extra general meeting and I got back involved as chairman, I don't think we've ever heard one of the deposed directors claim that they weren't trying to benefit from the assets.
Mm.
So I think it's fairly clear that was what was going on.
So what's happened now? There was an announcement last week. It looks like good news. What exactly is going on now?
Well, the good news is that we were due to go to the High Court at the end of this month. And we had been told by the barrister and the legal firm that represented us that we had an extremely strong case, and it was... highly unlikely that we wouldn't win it. We were also told at that point in time that the danger was that we would go to the High Court, we would win the case, the judge would order costs in our favour, but that we would be unlikely to reclaim them in full. And so the other side asked us for a get out clause. They would pay some of our costs, and we suggested a figure to them, which they came back and agreed to immediately. Now the good side of that means that the Carp Society is now back in safe hands again, and we can get on and do things and recruit members, because the world of angling needs an organisation like the Carp Society that's got lots of members who can stand up and speak for them about some of the difficult things that angling's facing now. The less good side of it is it's left us still with a pretty significant legal bill that we have to try and pay, and it also leaves us in a situation where Tim Paisley, who began the action on our behalf, has also kind of spent a significant sum of money. So we've got quite a long way to go in terms of fundraising. But the good thing is we can use Carp Society assets, and by that I mean we can have events at places like Horseshoe and Farriers and Langholm, and we can do some more with our conference, which will help us move it forward. So that's where I'm quick. We're all very optimistic. We're all very pleased. But we're not saying... It's just kind of completely sorted, because we've still got this money to raise.
Well, we can all help with the money. Obviously, anybody listening to this, it's probably a good time. You know that the money's in safe hands if you do join the Carp Society. What is the membership fee these days, then?
It's £25 a year, Jamie. And we're also looking at the possibility, which I will mention now, of some form of associate membership. We're also doing family memberships for £30. And we're running at least one junior carp camp, I think, in the next couple of months. And we're going to try and do a lot more with juniors in the future as well.
Fantastic. And you're going to be at the Northern Angling Show, I believe. You've got a stand there that's hopefully going to raise some money.
Yeah, we've got two big events coming up. We've got Five Lakes this weekend, yeah. Where we'll be represented, and we're coming up to the Northern Angling Show. Thank you for your kind support with that and helping us get a stand there, and we'll be trying to do some fundraising there as well. I'll blow your trumpet a little bit, Jamie, as we're talking. You offered us a donation in terms of a fishing session. We're going live with that tomorrow, on Saturday at Five Lakes, and people will be bidding for 48 hours on Farriers with you, and we'll carry that forward to the Northern Show till we get the best price we can. But thanks for your support.
Fantastic. I might pay myself to be able to go and fish on Farriers.
Well, there you go. That's what we thought. We thought that's our thank you to you. But we know that other people also would thoroughly enjoy a 48-hour session there. So that's really good.
Yeah, and for people that don't know, that maybe not aware, Farriers has been one of the most exclusive syndicates in the country for a number of years now. I remember when the Carp Society first purchased it, actually. I used to fish Horseshoe as my regular lake, and those fish have grown pretty impressively, haven't they, in the last 10 years?
Oh, absolutely fantastic. I mean, when you consider that they went in as a job lot of fish that Brian Sefton, who's another current director, managed to purchase. And everybody said the fish were, you know, stunted and they wouldn't grow. And when you look at the fact that it produced a 50 towards the end of last year, and there are numerous 40s and lots of 30s in there, it's an absolutely fantastic fishery.
Yeah, and a fantastic opportunity. If nobody wants to bid to come with me, I'll be bidding just to make sure I go on my own. You can do that at Five Lakes this coming weekend. You can do it on the Carp Society stand, I guess. You can enter a bid, and you'll be able to do it at the Northern Angling Show on the 1st and 2nd of April. And at some point we'll get the real dirt, will we, on what the previous directors have tried to do.
Yes, I think you will. I think we just want to be kind of quite secure in kind of our legal status before we do that. But yes, there's quite a lot of things been going on, Jamie, and I think the angling world would be quite shocked by some of them, really. But
okay, maybe we'll leave it there.
We'll come on and talk about that in due course, I hope.
Okay, well, thank you for your time, and I look forward to seeing you. Are you up north yourself, are you, in Manchester?
I'm not sure that I'll be up north, but I know that Miles Carter, who's our fisheries officer, has been fantastic throughout this dispute, because bear in mind, he was employed by the former directors and had to suffer some of the difficulties with them while he was being nominated to stand as a director with the new group. Yeah. So Miles will be there. Steve Hall, who's one of our northern directors, will be there. And I know a number of others. If I can get there at all, I will definitely try.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for your time, Derek, and enjoy your time out with the dogs.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. Okay.
We love a bit of gossip, don't we?
I don't know what you mean. But yeah, I'd also say to everyone that, you know, just on the last thing of that, go to the Carp Society website page and join up. Show support, and I will be doing. Can you join at the Northern Show? Are they there?
Yes. Yes, they are. That's why I ended up speaking to Derek. Derek rang me and asked if they could have a stand at the Northern Angling Show to try and raise some money. Obviously, they've got a lot of legal bills and stuff, so they were going to do some raffles and stuff there. And I offered some coaching as a prize with myself. They will be there. Go and check out the Carp Society stand at the show, along with 170, 180 other exhibitors. So, yeah, absolutely fantastic. I saw it worth a look, actually, this week. I've not watched it myself, but we know how funny Mark Pitchers and Harry Charrington are. They've given hours and hours of free content out for on YouTube for the last couple of years, and they've actually produced a DVD called In Pursuit of Carpiness, which I can only imagine is quite satirical. I think it's going to be a bit of a laugh. And yeah, if you listen to this, Mark or Harry, then send me one and we will happily review it for you, because I think that'll be quite funny. But the free content they put out for the last few years has always been pretty funny and decent, so I'm looking forward to having a look at that. A little worth a look. We've waited for him for quite a few months, been trying to pin Danny down, so I think it's going to be a slightly shorter show from us, because I'm coughing, you know, the amount of editing I'm having to do in this to cut the coughs out. timing is everything.
Going to be
ridiculous. So yeah, we'll leave it from us from here, Mark, and then we'll hand over to Corda main man, Mr. Donny Fairbrass.
Just had the first time I met you.
I'd like to welcome to the Carp Cast, probably one of our most requested anglers since we started this a couple of years ago, Mr. Danny Fairbrass. How you doing, pal?
I'm good, thanks, man. I'm good.
Good. Well, I think the last time I saw you was probably in a little room in Ibiza somewhere in Pasha. Do you remember?
I vaguely remember, but that was a lot of days and a lot of club nights ago. So, yeah, it all blends into one.
Yeah, yeah. Did you get married over there, or was it just the stag?
Yeah, I got married. Got married over there. What was it? 2011. Yeah, I've been going since 1992, and when I met my then girlfriend, now wife Sophie, we went together, and it the holiday completely transformed from what it, you know, the boys' holidays before, and started to see a much different side to the island that I hadn't really experienced that much of. The restaurant side, the slower side, the more chilled out side, and we go pretty much every year, and have been before and since we got married.
Yeah, same. It's, you know, for people that have never been to Ibiza, the stereotype is, you know, like Magaluf, you know,
yeah,
people off their heads running about the streets. But
that's what you see on television, and there is that side to it. And if you stay in San Antonio, that is what you're going to get exposed to 24/7. And as a youngster, when I first started going in the early 20s, that was amazing. You know, it was kicking off there every single night. The buzz was unbelievable. As, you know, a 40-something-year-old father now, I don't want to see all that going on all the time. I know it's happening and it's great for them, but, you know, I'd like to say I like the sort of cooler side of the island now.
Yeah, and there's a lot of it. Every time I go, I mean, I've got friends that have lived there for a number of years and stuff now, and as soon as you see that other side of the island, it's still the best place in the world, even if you take out all the party scene.
I'd still go there. If there was no clubbing, I'd still go there on holiday. You know, it's absolutely amazing. Just everything is, and I've been quite a lot of different places around the world, and I've never been anywhere that matches that vibe.
Exactly.
You know, it's so effortlessly cool. Everything's such a high standard. The quality of the food and everything is just so amazing, and the scenery and everything. If you go away from the sort of tourist traps, you know, I've done a lot of travelling around the island doing photography and stuff, and it's just spellbinding, and none of that really gets seen, because all you see is the madness of the clubs on telly, you know?
Exactly, and the clubs are not even in one place, they're all over the island, you know, there's nothing around most of them, is there? So it's definitely not what you imagine, and I missed out for 10 years because I thought I would hate everything about that place, you know, and it's the most magical place I've ever been to, and it cost me really by not going because of the TV, you know, that... you know, you imagine it being the Strip and a bit like a lot of other places, but there isn't. It's a tiny bit in San Antonio and that's it. But anyway, this is a fishing podcast, as much as we do go off at tangents. But yeah, that was funny. I mean, Roger Bacon got married over there as well, actually. Roger was with me, actually, in Pasha when we saw you. Yeah, he got married.
Yes, I remember. Yes.
Yeah, it's fantastic. They go back on their anniversary every year in April, May. I try and get there every year, but it's...
Yeah, nice.
I was a little bit hopeful it could have been a little bit more perfect if there was some sort of carp somewhere, some nice lake somewhere on the island, and they opened a decathlon there and they were selling carp gear and boilies in the decathlon. I was like, they wouldn't be selling that if there wasn't somewhere on the island, but I'm yet to find it if there is.
Well, I, a friend of mine that used to work for me actually years ago, he now lives there with his girlfriend and has done for probably 10 years, and there is... some fresh water. I was told by other people who lived there was no fresh water at all, but he's actually found somewhere like a quarry that has got carp in it.
Really?
It's like a death trap trying to get down to the water, and because obviously he's a carp angler, he doesn't get to go anymore. He's searched and searched and found this one place. There's no big ones in there. They're all little commons. But he has wet a line there once or twice.
Wow.
But yes, it would be lovely if there was, you know, if you can combine the whole thing, then I'm sure loads of, you know, the sort of Lake Shearer situation, you know, in Gran Canaria, you know, if that was replicated out there, wow, what a combination. But I've looked, and unfortunately it doesn't. So, you know
the price of everything else in Ibiza. Can you imagine what a day ticket?
Oh my God! Yeah. I would imagine the girls bringing you the drinks would be quite nice, though. So it would probably be worth it.
Yeah, imagine that waitress service on the lake. I like these tangents we go on to, but I suppose we better move on to more serious fishing stuff. So the first time I came across corder must have been the early days. I was fishing on Rodney Meadow in the early 90s. Heard this story. I think the first product I saw was probably, it wasn't the leads, which I knew you started off with. It was a type of fluorocarbon at the time. They're all... they weren't great, the fluorocarbons, back in those days. But, I mean, did it really happen with making leads in the kitchen at home to, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I started making the leads sort of commercially, if you like, in 92. So I bought my first mould, I would guess, 1990, 1991, at the Carp Society Conference at Dunstable. Just bought a DCA mould, which is like a sea fishing mould, like a zip style sort of, 2 and 3 ounce, and just started making them for myself, for the guys that fished on the same place as me. I was fishing the Little Grange in Essex at the time, and was always massively into camouflage, and was painting my leads and then varnishing them with matte varnish so that they, you know, drop them in the edge and making sure they matched all the clear spots, because it was gin clear over the Grange and a lot of fish got caught right out of the edge. I always liked tinkering with that side of it, so when these guys saw what I was making, that, you know, they wanted them, and then I started going around Walthamstow Reservoir selling a bucket of twos and a bucket of threes, no swivels on them. Yeah. And I walked around all weekend. If I got 20 quid out of the weekend, I'd done well. You know, that was the sort of scale of it at the start. I started making them for a couple of local shops, and they said, look, if you could do bigger and smaller sizes and do different shapes, there's definitely a market for it. So, yeah, I set about getting bespoke moulds made just for me and started in my kitchen.
I guess when we look back at the sort of carp boom, you know, in years to come or generations after ours, successful people quite often are in an industry at the right time, aren't they? They're in it in the early beginnings, and, you know, we're probably not a dissimilar age. And when I was a kid, like, we had to adapt everything for carp fishing. Like, there wasn't, you know, you went in your local tackle shop, it was all for course, you'd buy the biggest hooks you could buy, you know, you struggled to get really big leads and stuff. And I guess you were blessed with being in, you know, being a creative person in that at the right time. So, you know, you saw a gap in the market, shops wanted it, and all of a sudden you had to come.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't, people that managed to break through nowadays generally have something very unique, because there's so much available now, just in a catalogue. If you wanted to go out to China, you know, you could set up a range of rig gear on one trip to China, and I would imagine it would be quite soulless and quite sort of an also ran sort of outfit, and those things do come and go. But back then, there was the black carp bombs with the swivel set in the top. Mm. Roger and Kerry leads, which was local to just two or three shops. You know, Roger Smith, that used to be chairman of the Carp Society. It was them in a couple of shops. Zip leads, which were fast iron away, which is basically I did my leads, because the zip leads had gone down in quality and the loop on the top of the lead changed completely. And you couldn't get your bit of neoprene over the top of it for your helicopter rig. You Terry used this bit of thin black tubing and the little enamel beads. I don't know if you remember all that.
Yeah.
But that's what I used to use back in the day, the thinnest tubing I could possibly use. You know, Zenon was the big influence in Essex, and he was using helicopter rigs up at Savay and places like that. And we all sort of saw what he was using and sort of cobbled it together as best we could. It was the beginning of the explosion, shall we say. I started carping when I was probably 14 or 15, so sort of 84, 85. Like you say, using carbon specimen hooks from Drennan, you know, size 6 was massive. You know, normally it was like size 8s you're using, and just mono hook links you know, red beads to stop the lead hitting the swivel, and cause there's just nothing out there, you know. Mm. And yeah, like you say, being in the right place at the right time and having that that desire to be successful and having a reasonable degree of creativity at the same time was a potent combination.
And I think, like, from, you know, being a company producing N-Tackle, that there, it seemed to me as an outside observer, the time it really boomed for you was when you started doing the DVDs, the underwater stuff. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would say that the first underwater film was pretty pivotal because it was the first proper one of its kind. People had done it before, but it was the first proper one of its kind. And my personality being the way it is, I'm reasonably comfortable with being in front of the camera. I wouldn't say I'm completely comfortable at all, but the more you do it, the more comfortable you become. But the overwhelming thing for me was wanting to share the information. So even though I was nervous at the start of the day's filming, and still am at times, I think about the person watching it. I think, how can I pass on as much fish catching information to the guy watching as possible? And then that takes my nerves away, and I think about contributing to that guy rather than looking good or whatever in front of the camera. And that sort of pushes me on to do it. And I think that the underwater films, you know, there was no sort of argument about what worked and what didn't, because everyone was seeing things being picked up and blown out and then other things nailing them straight away. So, and the feedback we got from that, I mean, the amount of people that came up to me at shows afterwards and said, I have halved the length of my hook link and I'm catching twice as many fish. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You know, and it's things like that that push me on to do more, that motivate me to do more, you know, because it is, you know, it's a very sort of fickle industry and everyone's got their opinion. And if you listen to everybody, you probably wouldn't get out of bed in the morning, you know, but it's those people that take the time to come up and say, you have made a massive difference to my fishing. That's what inspires me to do more and more. And yeah, the underwater films, because they were pivotal in their sort of in their content, there was no better way to show that your stuff works. Yeah, again, it was that was definitely a turning point where we jumped up a level.
It's, I mean, I remember it well. It was mind blowing. Technology's changed a bit. I'll move on to that in a sec. But like, the question for any thinking angler was always like, what is actually going on, you know, under the water, because we can't see. You can see over the water, even if you're a really keen fish spotter, you know, you might have an edge on everybody else, but until you can actually see that fish sucking and blowing, you know, taking the bait, hooking itself, like all the millions of things you must have seen now, you know, a number of years on from that. I mean, for me, it was mind-blowing. It was just like, you know, everybody had to own that video. If you actually thought about what you were doing, you know, carp fishing wise, you had to go and buy that, the first one, for sure.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, you know, the lads on Stoneacres boat fishing have all got cameras on poles that they push under the water, and I mean the way technology has gone now, you know, my iPhone 7 goes underwater, and now, you know, just your normal phone you can stick. I mean, has that changed things for you, or has it just made it easier? But, you know, the equipment must be cheaper for you to do it as well now, I guess.
Not at the top level, it's not. No, I would say it's as expensive, if not more expensive, than it ever was. I would say the kit is more reliable. The thing we're up against nowadays is finding suitable places to better what we've already done, you know. And, you know, at the beginning, it didn't really matter what we call it, because the whole concept was so new. And then we're trying to, you know, either change the situation to expand everybody's sort of pool of knowledge or catch bigger fish, which we've done, you know, as the time's gone on. Obviously, getting the opportunity to fish on Welly for 5 and 6 underwater was a major, major coup. And like most of these things, all the planets have to line up for it to work. And one minute it seems like it's going to be a complete failure, and the next minute they're in there feeding and it kicks off, you know. But yeah, with the change of technology, I've still not seen anybody, as far as I'm aware, do one where they are, you know, they're fishing within the rules, they're not dropping it out by boat, that you're seeing everything, you're seeing the rig going, you're seeing the anglers on the bank, you're hearing the chat between them, that's being mixed in with the, what's going on underwater. No, the people have filmed fish getting caught under, you know, picking yeah. rigs up and getting hooked, but I haven't seen the whole thing done together, and I think that's probably testament to how difficult it is to set the whole thing up. I mean, for 7 and 8 underwater, when we went to Linear, to St John's, obviously that was the most advanced. We'd already been making TV shows by that point for some time. So with regards to crew and equipment, the underwater stuff was still quite temperamental. But you're talking about there's two cameras underwater. There's often another camera above the water filming the rig going in, you know, from the surface down. Then you've got another guy sitting there just looking at the rod, waiting for the bite. Mm. And then there's two more cameramen that are on the wide shot and the close shot filming you if anything happens. So, you know, you've got, what, a set of 6 cameras going all the time in order to create that film, you know. And I guess maybe that's something that's prohibitive for other people, is the cost involved in that is vast, yeah. you know. And if you're not getting anything, like at St John's, you know, we did a week and got nothing, you know, and you're talking about the cameraman's wages alone is a couple of grand a day.
Yeah.
You know, so we're 15 grand down and we haven't got a minute of footage, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, the old bum starts twitching at that point and you think, oh, is it ever going to work? And obviously it's quite difficult to keep the morale up with everybody. And then the next day, the temperature goes up 0.5 degrees, they come in and start feeding and you know, it's action stations, you know. Bit like in your own fishing, you know. I mean, last March, I fished the whole March for one bite. And then the first 2 weeks of April, I had 7 fish, all amazing, amazing fish, you know. So it does reflect what goes on. And back to your original thing, with a change in technology, I mean, yeah, you can now, if you go to the foreign shows, you can buy a marker pole that's got a camera in the bottom of it, that's got a transmitter in the top of the pole above the surface that transmits back to a screen. And obviously the camera's only got a certain battery life. But you can drop that pole anywhere you want, you know, within a couple of 100 metres of the bank anyway, and you can make an underwater film if you wanted to.
Wow, I've not heard of the poles.
yeah, they're you know, the guys in Europe are definitely inspired by what we do, and they're trying to push it on further still, you know, and as you know, there's amazing fishing to be had out there, yeah, they're getting some good footage. But like I say, no one's pieced the whole story together yet, as far as I'm aware, which I would love to see. I would love to see other people do it. I would love to learn from what they you know, find in their fishing. Because even with our ones, if you don't like the sound of my voice or you don't want to hear the soundtrack or what we're going on about, I would, you know, if I was in that position, I would turn it all down and just watch the underwater stuff and forget what everybody else was saying about it and make my own conclusions and let that affect my fishing, you know. So like you said at the start, every carp angler should have seen them all, and if they make up their own mind and are not influenced by us, then fine, you know. That's what it's all about, is increasing the pool of knowledge.
What are the most mind-blowing things you've come across with since you know how's it changed your fishing since you started filming underwater?
How it's changed my fishing, in the positive and the negative. Normally, when we finish one, I've then decided how I'm going to fish from then on. And obviously, the next situation you find yourself in is completely different from where you've just filmed, and the same rules do not apply. So I've made that mistake, definitely. You know, but I think generally, it makes me think underwater. So when I'm feeding the lead down or pulling a marker lead back across the bottom or winding a rig in with a bit of weed on it or whatever, I am trying to picture what it looks like out there. And I've done all the things, like, you know, like Stone Acres Boys, I've gone out on lakes where I can use a boat with the GoPro and drifted over spots and filmed them where the weed's coming up. But 2 weeks later, the weed's completely different. So it's null and void unless you want to go out there every single time you go. You know, it sometimes can steer you away from what's the right thing to do rather than put you towards it. But I'll say generally, I try and picture the underwater situation. So that's the biggest thing that it's done for my fishing.
Do you still use a marker float and stuff when you when you're fishing normal lakes?
I use the float itself very rarely now, because of the distance sticks, which I didn't adopt for years. All Jake Wildbore and all the other boys that worked for us at the time, the younger guys, were, you know, they just grew up with it. And I was still walking the lines out and, you know, counting the turns and all that sort of, had it all written down in my phone. And to my detriment, I should have got on them quicker. But now I think if I feel, I just use a marker rod with just a lead on the end.
Yeah.
So you've still got the braided line, so you feel more. And I'm casting around for what it feels like and a rough depth. And if it feels presentable and it's the range I want to fish at, because that's where I've seen fish or where I know fish are going to come through, then that's enough for me. I go around the, you know, clip it up, go around the sticks, do my fishing rods the same. I know how much shorter to make me spod rod if I'm going to spod, depending on the depth of water. And I've always found if I put a float out and try and cast it, I'll go round it.
Yeah.
And drag the whole thing in, and from the Elstow days, you know, it's I was finding the areas, finding the humps with a float, but not actually using the float to cast that.
Yeah.
And I was still dropping on the spot, because you know when you're in the shallow water or the deep water.
Yeah.
And it's sort of that place really, really honed my skills when it came to accuracy and baiting and everything else. And ever since then I've hardly used a float. Maybe at the start of it, so I'm doing a week session in France. At the start of the week I put the float out, so I know how much effort it takes to put the baits out with the throwing stick. You know, and maybe it's five at a time in the stick, goes 80 yards, and I know that from then on. And then from then on, I'm not using the float to aim at. I'm just putting five at a time in, and you know they're going roughly the same distance every time. The marker rod definitely, but the float itself, not very much.
Yeah, I had exactly the same transition. I looked at those sticks, thought, yeah, that's just a gimmick, it's pointless, and it's anybody who thinks like that is missing out severely, because like I say, you can do away with the float, you can just have a lead once you find, you know, where you're happy fishing, wrap it out, and you know, like, you can put three rods on it, like those Elstow days. Obviously I fished there as well for a short time, so I know exactly what you're talking about. They used to fish three rods very accurately on one spot, and you would never know, using a float, you would never know if one was a rod length longer than the other. And if you're fishing three rods on a spot and one's slightly longer because you've done it by sight, that can mess up the other two rods, because you've all of a sudden got a line a foot off the bottom going through.
And
I think of some of the waters I've fished over the years, and just the way we fish now is much better, much more accurate. Especially with those distance sticks. I mean, for putting three rods on the spot, finding the spot, wrapping it out. I mean, how much do you take off for the spot? You said that you know exactly how much to adjust for the depth. What are your rules of thumb for a...
Well, basically, one of the guys at work, one of the CAD designers, he's like part man, part computer. And Mickey's name is. And basically, if we want to do a new hook or whatever, we'll give like a child's drawing to Mick, and he will turn it into the most beautiful thing that you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And Damien actually got him to do a drawing where all the distances past the float were done exactly, depending on the depth of the water and the distance you fished.
Yeah.
The shallower the water, the less past the float you have to be, and the further out you are, the less past the float you have to be. So I think it was like 120 yards in 5 feet. You had to be 2 inches past the float to drop where the lead is on the bottom of the marker rod,
right.
You know, because the angle is so shallow. If you're fishing 30 yards out in 20 feet of water, then I would say it's something around 7 to 10 feet past the float. To drop in the same thing. So I go for, in normal depths, where most of us are fishing sort of 8 to 15 foot, aren't we? And in normal depths, at normal sort of ranges, I go for about a third of the depth of water past the float for the fishing rods, and then obviously take. The fishing rods are done exactly the same as the float, and then the spod or spom is done a third of the depth of the water shorter than the others. So it's hitting the surface basically where the lead is hitting the bottom, because there's a bit of swing back.
Yeah.
you know, that's what I go on roughly. And I think, you know, in that sort of situation, I think as long as I'm on my rigs or slightly behind them, I'm happy. I don't want to drop a load of bait over the main line short of the rig, you know, but being on the rig or slightly, you know, to be, if you wanted to be super careful, if you did it exactly the same distance, you'd be dropping the bait behind the rig, but obviously you're never forcing the fish to come into contact with the line. And I think we've seen with the underwater films that we've seen, if the rig's 3 foot away from the bait, he's still going to get picked up, you know. If it's 10 yards away from the bait, then maybe not, you know, but a few feet is nothing, I think, down there.
I'm glad you've come to the same conclusion as me. A third of the depth is my sort of rule of thumb. Yeah.
Right.
The thing that still always gets me, though, if I'm fishing quite a smallish spot, you know, amongst weed, where you've got to be exactly on the spot, otherwise you're in the weed, I'm leading around with the braid rod to find it, and then I wrap it up exact, and obviously with the stretching in mono, it's not quite the same. So do you have a rule of thumb there that you've kind of found is your auto go-to adjustment?
The thing about the stretch in the mono, it's how you hit how hard you hit the clip, and what the depth of the water is, you know, because as the lead is falling through the water, the stretch is coming out of the line the whole time, so it might stretch as it hits the clip. I mean, I'm feathering it down. So if I'm fishing at 80 yards, I'm trying to cast 81 yards. Yeah. So I'm barely hitting the clip, you know, I'm hitting it, you know, and it's laying the rig out straight and everything else. But it's not going boing and, you know, and pulling the rod forwards in my hand. I'm just about hitting it. I pull the rod tip back and then let the lead drop sort of not on a slack line, but, you know, I'm trying to take the stretch out of it, basically. So I go for the same distance from the marker rod to the fishing rod, and it doesn't seem to be doing me any harm, you know, with the way that I cast and how I hit the clip and fill the lead down. It doesn't seem to be doing me any harm so far. So when I bait up, I tend to bait up on what I think is dropping right on top of the rig and behind it. So I'll probably take 6 foot of line off the spod rod and reclip it and then spod again, so that I've got some behind the bait as well as some on top of it. In the sort of fishing I'm doing now, I'm boilie fishing most of the time. So I'm not doing your classic L-style or linear big hit sort of style fishing where you're trying to drop everything on a sixpence and have your rods literally crossing each other. They're so close together.
Yeah.
I don't really do that sort of fishing. I'm boilie fishing. I'm trying to fish over a sort of wider area, and maybe not if the spot's only small, the outside rigs are maybe set up so that they can fish effectively in a bit of weed. And there might be one rod on the clear area and two rods as the weed starts to get thicker on the outside of it. And spread the bait out over everything. I truly believe that once they're feeding, they'll just keep looking and looking and looking until they've found it all. And I've never seen any evidence of them only eating it on the clear spot. You know, in fact, sometimes I think that's the rod that is the last one to cut.
Yeah, I agree. As you'll know from the foreign anglers, the way they fish, I always think, I mean, they fish different to us because the lakes are different, usually bigger, you know, more fish, heavier baiting sort of thing. But quite often I've seen them, you know, they'll pour 50, 60 key of baiting at the start of the session. I mean, the sessions tend to be longer as well. And usually they'll fish, you know, the bite rod is quite often two or three rod lengths away from where they put the bait.
Yes.
And I know some people that won't fish on the bait because it just gets the small ones in, you know.
Yeah, well, but the bait in that situation, it's almost chum, isn't it? You're bringing in this pack or this herd of fish, and the young, hungry ones that want to grow and want to get big and be higher up in the pecking order are in there doing their level best to grow. And the big ones that, you know, have got slow metabolism and don't need to eat as much have maybe been caught a few times, they're quite happy where they are in the pecking order, thanks very much, so they can take their time. I've caught big ones from the edge of a baited area, you know, quite a few times. I wouldn't say I do it all the time. Sometimes you catch the big one right out of the middle of the spot, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I think it's, you know, the fact that we're allowed to use free rods most of the time means that you can muck about with your positioning And sometimes have won, you know, I don't know, further away than looks right, just in case there is something hanging about that doesn't dive in on the, you know, the big baited area. But again, it's like thinking underwater. I've seen so much of fish coming in and being very cautious of a big part of bait and maybe eating one or two right on the outside. And they keep coming back, and they keep coming back, and their confidence builds and builds and builds, and in the end, they're in there with three or four others, and they're feeding hard, you know, and then one gets caught. But very rarely have I ever seen big fish come straight into the middle of an area and just start eating, you know, the biggest concentration of bait straight away.
Yeah. I've always said that we catch carp when they hang themselves, usually. Like, no matter how tricky you think you are and how good your rigs are, generally the important thing is to create that feeding situation enough for them to drop their guard. And they drop the guard at other times, such as when conditions are absolutely perfect, mega, you know, really sort of, you know, when that big low pressure wind comes in. I think that excites them to the point where they're just going to eat anything in front of them. But I think usually they're just creating a situation. And when, you know, it doesn't matter how fantastic you are an angler, they get caught when you trick them into being confident, basically.
Absolutely. And the people you see coming out of match fishing and going into carp fishing, their attitude towards feeding is completely different to, you know, carp anglers. Put it all out at the start, sit there and wait, nothing happens, go home, you know, something was wrong with the bait or whatever, you know, they don't think I've put too much in, or I haven't put enough in, or I haven't read the swim right and they cleaned me out and I should have put more in or redone a rig or whatever. It's just, everything's just sitting there and it either happens or it doesn't. And I think that's the more I've fished, the more I realise that baiting correctly is such a weapon. You know, sometimes baiting and not fishing, when, you know, like not having lines in the water, you know, at the start of a session or during a session, can be absolutely devastational. And very, very few people seem to do that, you know, to wind everything in, put more in and just look and see what happens, you know. That's, you know, I think the underwater films are sort of talking about that when the fish get very sort of cautious of the area, you've got to bob in, and we're only fishing one rod at this point as well, remember. And even in the way when it looks rubbish, when you think there's nothing's going to be feeding on the bottom, all in there having it, you know, because there's no line in the water, you know, and you put a couple of food fresh at bait, a couple of, you know, they move off, you get, but you can see what's happening, you refresh the bait at just the right time, feeding at just the right time, and they come back in again, and you catch one at a time of day that you shouldn't catch one, tricked them into thinking you're not fishing again. And that's, you know, people that are highly observant in their fishing and are good at using bait as a weapon, you know, that is a very potent combination.
Two or three of the most consistent anglers I've seen over the last few years, people like Kev Hewitt, there's another chap called Nigel Ramsbottom there. Unless he's got some wonder ingredient in his bait, he must be one of the most consistent anglers out there. He's breaking late records for numbers every time he fishes. And the thing they've all got in common is regular spotting, spomming. They're like every 20 minutes they're out there day and night, and these guys are catching, you know, the hits that they're having on tricky lakes sometimes. Is ridiculous. So, I mean, is that how you approach your sort of baiting now? Are you baiting little and often?
It depends on the lake. I mean, I've been fortunate that the last couple of years I've had permission to fish a lake. There's only got a few people have got permission to fish it. Big lake, not many fish. And in that situation, it's the first time ever that I've mass pre-baited, because I'm not competing with any other anglers. So I'm basically training the fish to stay in the areas that I'm baiting. I'm not baiting many spots. And then I'm turning up and basically fishing singles at the start of a session over the remnants of the bait that's left. And then I'll, during the session, I'll put a load into the area I don't end up fishing and keep an eye on that during the session as well, and then move on to that if the fish turn up there. So, but I don't, in my normal fishing, I don't do that. So I'm not one for whacking a load of bait in and sod it. Whoever goes into the swim who doesn't know it's there, tough luck. I'm not that sort of angler at all. When I'm fishing with other anglers, I will, if the situation sort of, if it suits the situation to do it little and often, I will do that. If there's very, very few fish in the lake, I think that you can scare them away by doing little and often, you know, by sort of overcooking it, if you like. But I think if I've got to the point where I feel I should have called one, bite time has come and gone, and I can't look at what's down there, then yes, I will refresh and put more out and redo rods and that sort of thing. And when I'm getting lots of bites, I'm using bait, then I will bait up before I recast, with a view to scaring them away with freebies rather than scaring them away with the lead, and hopefully that gives enough of a window to get the rod out there again. And again, we've seen that from the underwater films. You know, you get a bite and the rest of the fish in the spot carry on feeding. You know, if you put a lead on top of them fish afterwards without putting any more bait in, they scatter. If you put some more bait out, they scatter, but they come back quicker.
Yeah.
You know, so by trickling, not going mad with the bait, if you're throwing sticky in, then 50 baits. If you're spotting, 2 spots, you know, is enough. Get the rod back in again, and then you can get another bite quickly. So I think it's all about, there's no one rule that I use for everywhere. And these guys that you talk about, I know Kev Hewitt does a bit of writing, but the other guy you mentioned, I don't know him.
Yeah.
And I think it's a shame that those guys don't share with all of us more of what they've learned. You know, I know some amazing anglers that have never written a word, never been in a magazine, who are just on a different level to me, completely different level. And I wish that they would share a bit more of what they have learned to add something to all of our fishing. But I'm the sort of person where I want to give as much information away as possible, and obviously other people are the opposite end, where they want to keep as much information to themselves. I understand that it's a very personal thing, but I would love to see more of these top guys that are under the radar, you know, come to the fore and give us all a few more sort of pearls of their wisdom.
Yeah, completely agree. Stop being selfish. Let us all catch more carp.
Yeah, I mean, it's so. I've talked to, you know, very sort of high profile anglers that share what they've learned, sort of in the least detailed ways possible, you know, and share it as little as possible because they see no value in sharing it. And for me, the sense of satisfaction that comes from a guy coming up to you and saying, that thing that you explained, it really made sense to me, I've used it and I've caught loads because of it. I've played a part in those catches, and that for me is, I know it sounds like a cliche, but it is as good as catching them yourself. It really is, and that feeling lasts, you know. And like, everyone knows me to be MD of Corder, and you know, all the stories out there of, you know, that I'm some sort of Alan Sugar-esque person that's, you know, that's trying to build this gigantic empire, and it couldn't be further from the truth. You know, my sense of satisfaction comes from contributing to an angler's enjoyment of the sport, you know. And yes, we've got to make a profit, and if you're not going forward, you're going backwards, and all of those things spur me on to make Calder as successful as it can be. But numbers on a balance sheet, or in these other guys' cases, photos in an album, don't give a lasting sense of satisfaction, in my opinion. You know, someone coming up to you and saying, you have made a difference to me, obviously in different words to that lasts. You know, it stays with you forever. You know, I can picture times when I was at shows, you know, and people come up to me 10 years ago, and I can tell you word for word what they said to me, because it really took me back, took me aback about what an impact I'd had on that person, you know. And I think if those people did that and got some feedback from it, I think they would be astonished at how it makes you feel.
As a human being, it's satisfying to be, you know, we all like companionship, we all like getting on with people, and it is so rewarding to do nice things, you know, and like to give back. I'm being more general than just fishing here, but it does sort of complete us. One way you're kind of giving back, tell us about the Embryo project.
Embryo basically came from, I was at one of the sponsored anglers' socials up at, where was it, Horseshoe, I think, and we're all having a couple of beers and chatting, and you've got sponsored anglers from up and down the country, and they were, that area, the Cotswold Water Park, is getting hit badly.
Yeah.
And I remember Mark Bryant was there, Rich Stewart was there, one of our photographers, he's freelance now, but now we're talking about the level of the problem. Simon Scott was there talking about the level of the problem, and it really sort of, we've been talking about it a lot anyway, and I just thought, you know, I've been involved in the Predation Action Group, and I've been to a load of different meetings with a lot of concerned anglers, but the legal argument, the political argument, looked like it was going to be like years and years and years of work to make very little gain. And I tried it for a while, and I've just found it very, very frustrating. Lots of talk, very little action. You know, that, I think that's always the case when you've got a group of concerned people together, that, you know, the focus, certainly back then, was talking about how bad it was, but no real plan of action to do anything about it. And I think now with Paisley at the helm a bit more now, I think that's changing. In fact, I know it's changing. And all credit to him, you know, he can sit on those committees and, you know, sort of get people to take some worthwhile action off the back of the concerns. But I found that very frustrating, that side of it. And I thought, well, what can I do that's going to make a difference in the short term and carry on making a difference? And I thought, well, if we can help people fence more lakes by making it much, much cheaper for them, or in some cases free, and we can create more fisheries, that has got to help protect the sport. You know, it's once a fence is round the lake, those fish, providing that fence is maintained, those fish are safe forevermore. You know, otters are not suddenly going to get wire cutters, you know, or have teeth that bite through all that sort of galvanised wire. You know, once you've solved the problem in that respect, you've solved it. You know, and then on to the next place and solve it there. And the same with the fisheries. I've been in loads of different syndicates over the years, and as a sort of generalisation, I would say there's a lot of cliques, a lot of secrecy, you know, a lot of unpleasant atmospheres at big fish lakes, because everybody's trying to keep it to themselves. Nobody wants more members. Nobody wants to pay more money for their ticket, you know, which I understand, you know, and as a result, they make it unpleasant to fish there. Or, you know, hey, you're going into someone's swim and there's a wet sling. Any good, mate? No, nothing. And I can't stand that attitude. I really can't stand it, you know. And I wanted to be able to create some fisheries where, you know, the people fishing there determined how many members you had. You know, so all of our people sign in and out, and people think, oh, it's just a pain in the arse, it's Big Brother watching over and everything else. But basically, if the lakes are too busy, then we'll reduce the membership, you know, so they're not too busy. You know, if they're not busy enough, so the fish are not getting fed enough, we'll increase the membership. Yeah. So by saying a syndicate's got 60 members, that's the right number. Well, if 50 of them have been members for 20 years and never fished it anymore, there's effectively 10 members, you know. So every time you go down there's loads of big fish in there, but there's nobody on. Yeah. You know, and those big fish don't reach their full potential because there's nobody on, you know, and you've got and there are a lot of places like that out there. And I'm fortunate to be a member of a couple of them. And it's, when you're a member, it's brilliant, you know, because every time you go, there's no one there. But are the fish reaching their full potential? I personally don't think so, you know. And also, being in it a long time now, I look at the bigger picture. There are so many people out there that could be enjoying the experience of being at them lakes, but simply cannot get a ticket because of this 60 people is enough sort of system. You know, it just seemed crazy to me. And I'm not saying that these lakes should go from one bloke on them to 20 blokes on them, you know, and be like some of the day ticket places that people have to put up with for big ones, but find a happy medium. So our motto is never empty, never full, you know. And so you can, when we create a new lake, we put the minimum number of swims on it we can. So the complete opposite to a day ticket is putting the maximum number of swims they can get away with.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's packed in like sardines 20 yards apart. You know, I just can't go down to them places because it's madness what people put up with, you know. And, you know, we put the minimum number of swims so everyone's got their own water. So there's no one can interfere with you, and you can go about your business, and no one's going to turn up and start marking or spomming or whatever and ruin it for you just on bite time, which has happened to me loads over the years, because people just don't seem to have any respect for their fellow angler. You know, like I've been at Welly, for example, and Ian McMillan, Ting Tong's opposite me. And I've turned up at first light, and they're showing out there and everything else, and he's opposite me, and it's 200 yards wide, and both the spots are 90 yards out. So we're 20 yards apart.
Yeah.
So I've gone round to him for a cup of tea at 11 o'clock. I watched these fish come out. He went, "Why aren't you cast out?" I said, "Mate, it's bite time. If I cast out now, you ain't going to catch one."
Yeah.
I said, "I'm here for 3 nights. I'll wait until bite time's come and gone, and then I'll put them out."
Yeah.
Oh, blimey, mate. Oh, God, that's nice of you. And if it had been him or anybody, it wasn't that it was him and we were mates. You know, it was, you know, I think, if there was no one down there, of course I'd put 3 rods out and try and catch one, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, there seems so little of that in fishing nowadays. It's just like, sod you, you're not even there. You don't count. I'm just going to do what I'm going to do. Sod you. And being in charge of the fisheries, I can create the rules that stop that happening, you know. And one of our rules is that if you turn up and someone's already fishing, then you should go around and check with that guy. If you're in the adjacent swim, where is he fishing? When is he going home? And if he's got an hour to go in his session, let him finish his session and then cast out. You know, why do you have to ruin it at 7 o'clock in the morning when that poor bloke's just about to get a bite, you know, and he's got an hour left, you know? And it's all about just a bit of mutual respect between the anglers, you know. And I think as the years go on, at the moment we haven't got big fish because they're all new fisheries pretty much, but as those fish grow and, you know, our different policies bear really, really great fruit, and we've got great bloodlines of fish in the lakes, they will be the places that everybody will want to get into, because they're not overrun with people, they're not really expensive, because it's not run for a profit. You know, just because the fish get massive doesn't mean to say we're going to treble the ticket price.
Right.
You know, it will be reasonable, because again, you can't, if you're selling tickets so cheap because you don't need to make a profit, you put the bloke who has got to make a living from his lake out of business.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to do that either. You know, places are 500, 600, 700, 800 quid because the bloke running it has got to earn a living.
Yeah.
And I'm in a fortunate position. I haven't got to earn a living because that quarter does that for me. So.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we've got an obligation, looking at the bigger picture, looking at the country as a whole, to make things really affordable for the average guy, but not so ridiculously cheap that the other places suffer as a result, you know. So, like I was at the very start, you know, that this sort of entrepreneurial and creative thing that is in me is put to very, very good effect with this. You're creating a lake from nothing a lot of the time, and there is nothing more rewarding than that. Seeing the stocking pictures, we just stocked one lake up in Oxford. We've just taken two lakes on a lease right next to each other that have been, one's been otter to death. It was run by a club, and the club has basically just given it up because they just can't handle it anymore. Membership's dwindling to nothing. We even said to them that we would put the fence up for free, and they said, "Do you know what? We've done our time. We've had enough. You take it on." And very, very kindly, they put us in touch with the landowner and recommended us as the next tenant. And we've taken on these two lakes. And the fish that have gone in there are absolutely spellbinding. We're in partnership with a guy called Paul Middleton, and he's got his own syndicate and a little fish farming business in Essex. And we've basically taken on the fish farming side of it because he didn't want to carry that on. So we're growing fish on from 10 pounds to between 15 and 25 and then stocking them. And these fish are just absolutely spellbinding, every shape and size and scale pattern you can imagine. You know, those have gone in, plus some of Simon Scott's fish. And because a fence has gone up before the fish have gone in, they're safe forevermore now in an area that is getting hit badly. And, you know, the feedback we're already getting from the local anglers in Oxford is that in 10 years' time, if the clubs in the area don't fence, which a lot of them are not going to because they don't own the lakes, which is another crazy policy.
Yeah.
I don't understand that at all. They've been tenants for 20 years. They're going to be for indefinitely. Throw a fence up around it, you know, but they're not. And the local anglers can see that places like these two lakes we've taken on will be the jewels of that area in 5 to 10 years' time. You know, when the other places get hit more and more, you know, that the available high quality fishing is going to be thin on the ground. And I fear for angling generally, because there is syndicate owners that I think are very proactive. You know, that is their livelihood. They are putting fences up. Lots of people have already done it themselves, and we're getting booked to put fencing up, you know, a long time in advance. We're booked up until like October. Already this year. And our guys can throw a fence up really quickly. Being carp anglers, they don't leave it until it's secure, you know. But, you know, still, there are lots and lots of clubs that are sticking their head in the sand, you know, and have lost one fish or two fish, you know, and consider it to not be a problem. And I was speaking to Simon Scott recently, it's 10 times worse this year than it was last year, and it was bad last year.
I agree. The club waters are the hardest ones, because quite often they've inherited the fish, or they haven't spent the, you know, if you're spending 40 grand on stock now, you're going to put a fence up first. I think that's the future. You'd be crazy. I think we'll look back in 10 years time and go, why would you ever spend that money and not protect your assets before you've done it? It's like buying a new digger if you own a farm and then just leaving it outside at night, or, you know, like, you wouldn't do it. You'd secure your assets, don't you?
No, I mean, and the people that are spending that amount of money are doing it. But like you say, it's clubs that it's built up over a long period, or they've inherited the fish, or they don't know how good a water they've got. Perhaps the guys that are on the committee have been doing it 30 years, you know, and with the best will in the world are a bit stuck in their ways, you know, and, you know, and a lot of clubs, you know, carp anglers are the enemy, you know, and, you know, if it's run by guys that have been match anglers all their lives. I was in clubs, you know, the Elm Park Club in Essex, remember years ago, going for your interview and everything else, and, you know, if you fish for carp, you really were, you know, you were bottom of the food chain, you know. You know, I'm all for live and let live, you know. If you enjoy your own fishing and you're not harming anybody else, then do it, you know. And I think it's wrong to generalise that all carp anglers are bad for clubs and all match anglers are bad for clubs. It's, you know, individuals that have got a very blinkered point of view in all this. You know, unfortunately, that their waters are going to suffer as a result of that point of view. And I hope people do start taking more sort of, start learning from other people's mistakes. And if people in your area are losing fish, you are going to soon be losing fish if you're not already, you know. And, like I say, I do fear for the long-term future of the sport if these people continue to stick their head in the sand, because, you know, as rivers are getting emptied of fish in the areas where otters are prevalent, you know, that there are more and more and more, you know, take South Ings, our first ever lake up in Yorkshire. We put a 20 grand fence up, we paid Otter Stop to do it, they made a fantastic job of it, put the fish in from Simon Scott. A few weeks down the line, we've got some more fish coming up from the Lee Valley Syndicate, where we've done a deal, we've put their fence up and they've given us fish in return from their own growing on ponds. We get a phone call on the way up there, don't come, there's dead fish everywhere, you know, and otters have got in, and we'd lost 14 of Scotty's fish literally in two or three nights, you know, two or three grand's worth of fish, and professionals have put it up and they've done a fantastic job, you know, and basically the ground was soft, the otters pushed its way underneath the skirt that faces out along the floor, and they're clean, and in a few days that no one walked the lake, they got 14 fish, you know. And that is the level. If there's a lake in that area, up in that sort of where Carp Talk is, basically, that sort of whole area, if there's a lake up there that hasn't got a fence around it, there's otters on it all the time, you know. You know, people that believe it's not happening are deluded, in my opinion, you know, because we're seeing the real results of it. And, you know, the poor blokes who have just sort of come on board voluntarily to run the syndicate, pushing wheelbarrows down full of dead carp. You know, that is a horrible, horrible situation to be in. And, you know, I hope more people heed that sort of warning. And, you know, if they're not on your water yet, they will be within a couple of years.
So how does Embryo work? You own, what, four or five lakes currently, or control?
Yeah, we've got, the ones we own, basically, although Embryo is set up in my name, I'm setting up like a board of trustees. So beyond me, the lakes don't go into my estate. The lakes are owned by Embryo, which at the moment is funded by me. So when I'm dead and gone, embryo will be run by a board of trustees, you know, for the betterment of fishing. So those ones that we've bought, and it's only a couple that we've bought so far, most of them we rent, but the ones we bought, they will be carp fisheries forevermore. You know, that is guaranteed the future of those fisheries. And there's so many people out there vying for water, whether they're jet skis or wildlife groups or people want to fill it in and put houses on it or whatever. The competition is fierce for lakes now. Everyone we go for, there's 10 other people going for the same one.
Right.
You know, and they've all got pots of money behind them as well. And, you know, that is going to continue happening. So those ones are safe forever. All the others we take on long leases, so 15 years plus most of the time. And we would hope that being good tenants and paying our bills, you know, mean that, you know, all those leases get renewed, you know, when they expire.
Yeah.
And the lakes stay fisheries forevermore. So, you know, the whole thing for me is to leave some kind of legacy that has supported the sport that I love so much, you know, as much as possible. And I'm in the fortunate position now, with Calder being successful, I can take time and energy away from it and put it into something else that I'm passionate about. And, you know, fishing saved me as a kid. You know, I was, you know, spotty, skinny with braces. You know, there's no chance of any contact with the opposite sex. So I went on my bike every day at the summer holidays and went fishing. And I think about kids nowadays that want to get into it and maybe can't because there isn't a water near them. And that, if those waters shrink and shrink, people are not going to get into it as much, you know. And I think that would be a sad day. So, you know, the long-term plan, I think we're renting about, we've got three or four more coming online this year. I think we're renting about 10 by the end of this year, and owning a couple more, which is, a right result, really, in only being in existence sort of 3 years this July. Matt and now James, who run Embryo, are doing a fantastic job of securing as many leases as possible. You know, the sky's the limit. You know, if we have 100 venues in 15 years' time, you know, they'll all be run as individual waters. There won't be a blanket rule that covers all. Everything's done to suit the water in that area. They're all run by a local passionate angler who does it purely voluntarily. So everything's done at, you know, a local level. So you don't feel like you're part of this great big group where somebody on high is telling you what to do. Yes, we've got guidelines of, you know, of how people should behave when they're on the lakes, but it is very much down to the local guys running it to make sure that the atmosphere is right and the growth of the fish is right and the membership's right.
And the fencing side of it, how does that work? How do people apply?
So if you just go on to embryoangling.org, all the contact details are on there. And just put an inquiry in. Our guys are a very good. Like James will go. Literally, you can tell him the lake. He'll go on to Land Registry or Google Maps or whatever, and he will give you a rough idea of the perimeter of your lake on the phone, and give you a rough idea of the price on the phone. But it is only a ballpark figure because the amount of clearance, the amount of gates you have to have, if there's public footpaths. You know, if the terrain's up and down, if there's bits where, you know, you've got to come well away from the water's edge in order to keep the fence nice and straight, all those things affect what it's going to cost. But generally, it's going to cost a lot less than if you went to an outside fencing contractor who is just trying to make a profit out of it, because all we're doing with those jobs is trying to cover our costs.
Yeah.
So we bought the post banger, you know, that puts the post in the ground. That's 30 grand to buy new. You know, we had to buy a truck to pull it. That's 20 grand new, you know. The guys have obviously got expenses of getting there and everything else, as well as the fencing materials themselves. So we throw all that together and we look to just cover our costs, you know, job by job. And then if it's, say, it's a club that's totally non-for-profit, or there's a syndicate that's non-for-profit and they just haven't got any money in bank at all, and they're in a risky area for predation, or they've already been predated on, those ones may qualify for a free fence.
Yeah.
You know, and that's me just putting my hand in my pocket and thinking, oh, I'm doing a good thing, protecting these fish forevermore. Once it's done, if it's done right, it's only done once, and then you can move on to the next one. And, you know, like I say, the sort of financial side of things for me is sorted because of Calder, and I'm in that fortunate position that I can afford to put something back into the sport and expect nothing else in return for it other than knowing I've done a good thing. And absolutely. People might be thinking, oh, you know, that's, you know, he's spinning us a yarn and, you know, he's going to want to take over all these places. And, you know, if that's how cynical you are, then that's up to you. But perhaps when I'm dead and gone, everyone will actually believe me.
One thing I've learned getting older is, and especially if you've been successful, you know, I speak to Kevin Nash a lot. He comes on this show a lot, and he's at the same state of mind. I'm sure you guys were all very driven when you were younger. But once you get successful, the putting back, leaving a legacy, it's a very common thing amongst you know, people, especially in industries that have been good to them. I completely believe your sincerity in this, and obviously the time's gonna show people that anyway, if there are any doubters. But so embryoangling.org is the website. We've been an hour already, and I haven't touched on half the things I wanted to. So I'd love to get you back at some point if we can.
Let's talk about it again another time.
I want to talk about your foreign fishing, South Africa, Gigantica, BCAC, all sorts of stuff. But
you made your point. We will chat again soon. I'm off to South Africa on Friday actually for my annual pilgrimage. So I'll have some up to date information about that next time that we talk. Hopefully, it means that they've all been growing and. They're still feeding well out there.
Fantastic. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for your time, and I hope to get you back sometime in the next couple of months.
Brilliant. All right, mate. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tony.
Cheers, Tony. See you, mate.
Check out the website at www.thecupcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free